Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 261 for April 5th, 2023. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk to one of Andrew's former students about his field school experience in Scotland. So get your passport ready. I'm sure I've said that one before because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Andrew in California.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
And also Bill in California.
Yep. Good morning.
All right. Well, guys, we have a guest today. Hopefully, you know, internet and flooding and all that stuff doesn't stop us today because, you know, California is pretty much a garbage pit of weather right now.
it's very soggy. It's soggy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, the weeds in my yard are evildoers that have grown up to my thigh, basically. And I was out there with my son chopping them down, and in about 30 minutes, we filled our entire compost bin with weeds and made it like 5 square feet. You know?
Oh my god,
dude! In our backyard, I think it's a spring. Like, I'm not kidding. There's a place in our backyard where it's so wet that it's like 80% water and like 20% dirt. And I'm like, dude, was there an ancient spring here? Like, it seemed, I think the rains fed the ancient spring.
Well, there's some stuff really, if you have been watching this recent season of The Mandalorian, maybe you should go swim in it. You never know.
Oh, shit. But, I haven't seen that yet.
Put your helmet on and don't take it off and swim in the water.
Right.
Nice. All right. Well, we have a guest today, and it's Andrew's guest and Andrew's topic today. So I'm going to throw it over to him to introduce him.
Okay. So on our humble show this afternoon, we have my student Griffin Fox. And the reason why I wanted to invite Griffin on here is because, well, he's had actually a lot of experiences in archaeology in his young life. But one of the ones that I thought was really interesting is he went to Scotland over the summer and was part of an archaeology project there. But that project was run by basically a person who works in CRM. And I thought it would be really interesting first just to get Griffin to tell us his background and what he's doing in archaeology and intro himself, and then get into how field schools and CRM work together in some countries, and we can compare it to ours, where so often they don't. So with that, Griffin, just tell us who you are and how's it going?
So I'm Griffin Fox. I'm currently an associate archaeologist in the wonderful world of CRM. Before that, as previously mentioned, I started my anthropology/archaeology career at Moorpark, learning from Andrew in his field classes and such, after which I transferred to UCSB, did some more field and lab work and other things of that sort there. My archaeology career, quote unquote, even though I wasn't being paid, started with Andrew's field classes. I learned how to excavate very early on, which is unfortunately a very rare thing in archaeology, I later came to learn. Mm-hmm. When I transferred to UCSB, all the other students I was with were all like, oh, you've actually dug before? And I was like, you haven't? So that was very jarring and unfortunate to see. So yeah, then after that, I worked with now Dr. Caitlin Brown, who was at the time a grad student at UCSB, and I did more field and lab work with her on her dissertation. I moved on to compose an undergraduate thesis with Dr. Doug Kennett while I was there. I experienced the wonderful world of COVID, which was cool. I guess.
Yeah, that's right. You had the sort of bummer experience at a place like UCSB, where once you get there and then you're like, oh, you have to stay home and not go to the beach.
Yeah, it was strange. Very strange.
Yeah.
I think I made it work well enough, at least with like undergrad experience. Going outside was a bit of a no-no, obviously, but
mm-hmm. No, it felt like it went really well for you. Ultimately, I felt like you and a lot of your cohort, you know, played it pretty well, basically as well as could be, you know, so good for you, man.
I played my cards right. And I just figured, like, since the whole world shut down, I might as well just see what I can do, and anything I can do, I will. And that ended up being more than I anticipated, which was good.
Yeah. You know, at that point, as you're sort of finishing off at UCSB, how did you get in touch with the Scotland Project?
That was a while after about a year after I graduated. I had been working first at the repository at UCSB, and then I switched over to CRM. But I had just come to realize, like, as much as I love California archaeology, it's not really my end goal. I've lived in California my whole life, and I'd like to get experience and live in other parts of the world. And then my friend Stephanie, who was also in your classes, as you know, she was actually the one who found it, and she posted about it on Instagram, and it just piqued my interest because it was, one, very affordable, and two, like, I'd always been interested in Scottish archaeology, but obviously UCSB mixed with COVID was a terrible mix for trying to study that sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty bad. So, almost perfectly terrible.
Almost exactly the opposite of what you want if you're trying to understand Picts.
Mm-hmm. You know, let me jump in real quick, because you mentioned you had been interested in Scottish archaeology, but was that the additional drive to get you into wanting to study archaeology, or was it just general archaeology, you know, as a field that you were interested in?
So, I guess I should talk about how I got into archaeology to begin with, because when I got to Moorpark, I didn't really know what I wanted to do whatsoever. And that's why I went to Moorpark as opposed to a 4-year, because I wasn't going to spend thousands of dollars to be an undeclared major.
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah. So my first class actually was Native American history taught by Susan Kinkella, because I'd always had some vague interest in learning about the pre-contact Americas that obviously they don't really teach in your K-12, but I figured it must be a thing we know something about. And I was happy to learn I was correct. Mm-hmm. And then from there, she plugged Andrew's classes about, it was the archaeology of like the tribes of California.
Oh, right.
And I thought, And I thought that sounded interesting. So then I took that class, and from there declared anthropology as my major. And that's where we're at now. It snowballed from there. Kinkella basically gave me Stockholm syndrome. Now I can't leave.
There you go. See, there's so much there that shows what I'm really like. I can't actually get students. I need my wife to do it for me, you know, just so I can actually get a few people in the seats.
All the pieces are coming together now. I was kind of wondering what that missing piece was, and that all makes sense now.
Yeah. everything together.
By the time I realized my mistake, it was too late.
So late.
And he convinced you, he was like, you can't leave now, nobody else will take you. I was like, that's a good point, I'm stuck.
Oh, nice. All right, so back to Scotland.
So I learned about that field school. It was cheap, fairly quick. It was only 5 days, but I mean, for me, like, between CRM and Andrew's classes and my other various experiences, I'd had enough field experience to where I didn't feel like I needed longer than that necessarily.
I think that's very fair. I totally get that.
I would have done it longer had it been offered longer, but you know, 5 days was what it was, and for the price, that's what I was going to do. So I signed up for that, myself and a couple of my friends, and then in August 2022 is when we actually went. Yeah, it was run by Dr. Murray Cook, who I forget his official title because it's all different over there, but he's something like the Stirling City Council's archaeologist or something akin to that. And it's basically what his job is, basically what like a project manager mixed with like crew chief almost would do in an American CRM firm, but it's paid for and run by the city instead of by a private firm.
Yeah. See, just that setup, I find so interesting, you know, because we don't have, it's like where we live, city of Moorpark is going to put money towards an archaeology project. What? You know, it's so foreign and kind of in the best sense of the word, you know.
It was, very jarring, but also I almost wish ours was a little more like that sometimes. I get why it can't be, but it seems to, I don't want to say work better, but work in a much more streamlined way, a lot less parties involved.
Yeah. Well, I think some of that has to do with why the city over there would be, you know, the ones driving that and more concerned with it is, if I'm not mistaken, I wish Doug could have made the show today, but if I'm not mistaken, at least in England, and I thought the entire UK, pretty much everything under the ground is owned by the crown. Like, you have to report it. It's, you know, it's something that you just know that, right? And so every time you dig, every time you make something or do something, there's archaeology everywhere, right? You can't drop a spoon in the UK without finding archaeology under the ground, and they appreciate those resources. So yeah, it totally makes sense, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same here, you know, in the States. I mean, obviously we have laws and stuff, but the ownership is different, and depending on where you're at, and then obviously the regulation is different depending on where you're at. So yeah, very different system.
Yeah, for sure. One thing about the ownership, actually, which was very jarring, but I guess it was fine there. The site we were digging at was Pictish and then a hint of medieval, some other stuff as well. Mm. But those were the two like largest inhabited settings. Mm-hmm. We'd find a lot of Victorian stuff, which is, you know, basically our equivalent of like historic cans, bottles, like early 1900s type thing.
Yeah, right.
And anytime we found something like that, Murray was like, yeah, no, we find that stuff all the time. You can just keep that. And I was like, whoa, really? What? That's looting.
Nice.
So that alone was a very jarring difference.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it ties into, what you were saying about like how it's all basically run by the government and owned by the crown, from what I understand. And I think also because archaeology over there is more of a subsect of history than anthropology, and because most of the archaeology in the United States is about a different group of people versus in the UK, it's always been the UK more or less. There isn't that like contact element. So just the whole nature of it on a very fundamental level is the perception of it is so vastly different. There was another big thing was the site we were working at. It was not at all kept secret. It was in the middle of a park that people were just walking around at all hours of the day. We were just right off a path, so people would be walking their dogs or just walking right by us. And sometimes they would stop and just ask like, oh, what's going on over here? Mm-hmm. And instead of having to come up with some cover story, as I'm sure we're all used to,
right?
Murray would just my keys. Tell them. Yeah, exactly. Oh,
I haven't used that one. That's great.
That is a good one. Yeah. I'll use that next time. But no, instead of that, he would just tell them exactly what was going on, what we found so far, what the site was, what the boundary, everything.
Yeah.
And again, for me, that was so jarring for someone who's always having to be like, oh, I'm a geologist. I'm a biologist. I'm just here to check SoCal Edison's power line. Like, you know, say anything but archaeology over here, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's such an interesting, take, and it seems healthy in so many ways, you know. Hell, look at people, they're interested. You can tell the truth. Oh my God. You know, and just, I don't know. I would love at if some point in our own country we could get to a place like that, you know, where we can just be relaxed.
And, for sure.
And fill the general public's interest because they're curious about their own history, you know.
Why don't we go ahead and take a break real quick, and then we'll find out, because I want to get into, you know, really what the field school was like, you know, the day-to-day, what you guys were, you know, just an experience for somebody who hasn't done a field school over in Scotland, because that's exactly what we're talking about, right? So just kind of like everything about it, getting over there and all that stuff, and that's going to be a little bit long and I don't want to break it up, so we'll take a break now and then we'll come back on the other side and have that whole segment to talk about it. So back in a minute.
So welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and we have been talking about field school in Scotland with my student Griffin Fox. And Griffin, I thought during this segment that we could really take a deep dive into the field school, because so many of us haven't worked in Europe before, have no idea how a field school in Scotland goes. What's the daily setup, you know, for a field school in Scotland? What do you do in the morning? You know, where do you stay at night and that kind of thing? So if you could just sort of take us through that experience, I think that could be really cool. So how did it go for you?
So I guess for starters, I should say I was in the city of Stirling, which I think I've already touched on. It's not at all like, it's not the Highlands. I was not roughing it up in the mountains, as fun as that would have been. So I was just staying in a hostel in town. It was a 10 to 15 minute walk, give or take, from my room to the site. So not exactly roughing it. It was pretty easy in that regard. But that all, of course, that would vary if you're working up in the Highlands or somewhere else in Europe or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Other than that, the actual work, we dug four trenches, I want to say. Three or four. I'm pretty sure it was four. Yeah. Four trenches, which was a wider area of digging than I've been used to here in the States. I've only
right.
ever done
just when you said
tests with the units.
When you said like four trenches, I was like, whoa, you know, yeah. So about how big were they? Like how big were the trenches?
I forget the exact measurement. It was something like, I think it was 2 meters by 4 or 5, give or take.
Yeah. Jeez. So big, this was large.
They were quite large. Yeah. But there was 20 plus people there. So, I mean, it went by fairly quickly, but
right. Mm. Were you digging like, you know, 10 centimeter levels, or how did you guys go down as you went?
So they were much less concerned with stratigraphy, at least on that project, I think, because it had already been so badly compromised that we weren't taking as exact measurements. And I even asked them about it, and they were not concerned. They were interested that us as Americans were more interested in that. It's kind of funny. That could just be a project by project thing, but at least in that one, it was, yeah, no, stratigraphy and measurements were not nearly as, if we found some very notable artifact, there was more measurements being taken. And obviously the dimensions of the artifacts themselves and all that were being taken, but depth and placement was a lot less emphasized over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then you dig for a while, and then you guys, what, break for lunch, or do you have like a mid-morning break, or is there, you know, like a tea time or something that would happen over there across the pond?
There was, in fact, a tea time, which was very funny. Uh-huh. The most stereotypical UK thing. There was tea time about 2 hours in, and then 2 hours after that was lunch. And then we'd get one more break in the afternoon before we packed up for the day. And we were basically there from 9 to 5, give or take.
Right.
Yeah.
It sounds pretty straightforward. And also your living accommodations, man, that sounds nice. You know, I'm jealous that they were able to set up a project like that where the crew could stay at a hostel type situation super close to the site. So as a crew, did you guys just all like walk down together in the morning?
Well, I should preface it. Food and lodging and all that was not accommodated for. That was something we had to find ourselves.
Right.
So that was just what me and my friends stumbled on, was that hostel.
So everyone would like stay in town.
More or less. Some people who were actually living in Scotland would just commute from whatever city they were in.
Right.
Like there was a couple people who would take the train from Edinburgh or whatever. There was other people like farther away, but still in the city that would still need to take the train or whatever to get close enough. But me and my friends all stayed in the same place, and we just walked, and a couple other people did the same.
Right.
It was very much, that's why I say not a traditional field school per se, because it was very much just you pay for the digging experience. The rest is up to you, which in some ways I kind of liked, because I know oftentimes field schools can, I don't want to say scam, but they can put you up in a place that isn't ideal or
right.
I don't know. There's a
lot
more.
I think you can say scam.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be a scam.
Yeah.
But I appreciated the agency that it, like separate, that paying for your own food and housing and all that allowed for.
Right. I think it's excellent. Bill, I can see your question. Yeah. What's up, man?
I wanted to know, were there any folks that were getting stipends or anything on that? Or were the people who were
directing the project, were they getting paid, or was it just only the city archaeologist who was getting paid and everyone else was paying to be there?
There was like one or two, I want to say, other people who were getting paid. He had a crew of like supervisors. I don't know if they had an official title. Like, I don't think they were being paid by the city, but he gave them a stipend. There was one who was another fully trained professional archaeologist, and then he had a couple undergrads and grad students that he had worked with long enough that were basically helping him run the show. They were getting compensated for gas money at the very least. I'm not sure how much further the pay went, but they were definitely getting something.
Right on.
Yeah.
No, that's great. I can't get over the organization of this. And I just, you know, Griffin, when you originally told me about this, I was, of course, insanely jealous because it was a good idea that I was not a part of.
And that must have been hard for you.
It was very difficult. I went into a period of mourning for myself. But yeah, I was really impressed, you know, and Murray sounded like he was doing something in such an intelligent, reasonable manner, you know, and of those people on the crew, I'm curious about where they want to go with their lives. Like we know where you want to go with yours. You want to go onward and get a PhD and all this kind of good stuff. But did you get a sense of what the other people on that crew wanted to do, that they want to continue in CRM, or, you know, what did they want?
Yeah. I didn't interrogate them specifically on it, but it was a mixed bag. There was one that I know is basically like Murray's apprentice, quote unquote, mm-hmm. trying to do the same thing, the CRM, or it's not called that over there, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's others that are currently just trying to get their bachelor's and or master's. I couldn't tell you if they're trying to get more into that public archaeology side of things or academics. But I mean, it seems much more hand in hand over there also. So it could really go either way.
Right. And then in terms of the CRM, when you said they don't call it that there, what do they call it there?
I think the official term is just public archaeology.
Oh, another completely reasonable term.
Yeah, right. How about that?
What's up with that?
Yeah. When Murray introduced himself, he did say CRM, but I'm pretty sure he was just saying that for us as Americans, like as a frame of reference for what he does. Because I've, in all my other dialogues with European archaeologists, I don't often hear the phrase CRM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Me neither. No, that's cool that he was speaking your language in order to get you to understand what was in store for you.
Dumbing it down for the stupid, ignorant Americans.
Exactly. So I know that this experience affected you in a very positive way. Again, I became instantly jealous because, you know, another professor that you liked him better than me. Has this influenced your choices in terms of grad school or career choice or, you know, moving forward?
Well, I did not realize how niche Scottish archaeology actually was. Mm-hmm. I assumed it had been all kind of very much documented and was like a get in line kind of situation.
Right.
As it turns out, that's not the case, because for a very long time, they were basing all Scottish archaeology, or all Pictish archaeology at least, off of Roman accounts, mm-hmm. which, as we know, I feel like as American archaeologists, history is oftentimes biased. But over there, since it's archaeology is a subsect of history, they hadn't had that realization as recently as we have. And so there's a big gap in actual authentic knowledge on the Picts that I think I would like to, going forward, study more. And I think with my background working mostly in prehistoric contexts without written word, I think I'll have something of an advantage. So yeah, basically it did shape my entire grad school approach.
Right. No, that's great. And a couple things there. First, when you say Pictish, I don't know what that is. So I'm wondering if you just explain the basics of like how old it is, time period, you know, what is meant by the word Pictish?
Yeah. So it's actually kind of a blanket term almost. It's what the Romans referred to the Scottish tribes as when they were conquering the entire world, or at least trying to.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the exact time range. It's obviously they exist a little before the Romans, and then basically fade away with them when like the Iron Age and the Vikings and all that come into play. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's a catch-all term. They were called Picts because they would like cover themselves in war paint and then Pict, Latin, like picture. They looked like paintings. That's why the Romans called them that.
Yeah, interesting, man. And then for you, so you have this experience in a, you know, what feels like a local, almost, you know, local city archaeology project that has a very CRM flavor to it. And then you take it back home. And then for your grad school, is this something you looked for in terms of where you were applying with the professors, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I applied to a lot of Scottish schools, actually, because, you know, that would be the place to learn about Scotland. But then there's all the issues with going to grad school as an international student, the mm-hmm. lack of funding, the much quicker and much less personal, I want to say, grad programs over there, which have their pros and cons. I think for me, the American system would work better. It sure. seems more in line with my ways of approaching these things. But yeah, so then I looked at American schools as well that had European archaeology programs, one of which was Buffalo. And while they didn't have a Pictish or Scottish archaeologist on staff, I talked with the people there and there was enough of a collection of faculty there for it to work for me. And then I would just have to do some networking on my own, which I've already done. And I feel confident in my ability to do more of. So right. that's where I'm at now.
No, I think that's great. And another thing that I think it's excellent that you bring up is you're an American student who wants to work in Europe. And I've seen other students like that in the past try and do that. And I know it's pretty difficult because like if you want to work in the Maya world, you know, or this kind of thing, or work in the desert Southwest or something like that, there's a lot of choices, right? So many mm-hmm. of my students in my cohort when I was a student, you know, we all ended up in that kind of stuff, or to South America, to Peru or this kind of thing. But going someplace like Scotland, I thought was intrinsically pretty hard because it seems like there's not that much in terms of faculty in the four-year world who can take students on to do that. It seems like, as you would think, it seems like it's all in Europe. Was it difficult to find even a place like Buffalo?
It was. I actually only reached out to Buffalo because I had heard just through the years that they had a decent European archaeology program. But like I said, nobody focusing on Scotland. So I just reached out as kind of a last ditch effort, really. I asked right. them if I, like, the man I reached out to, I basically said, I know you don't work in Scotland, but would you consider like advising me for a master's? And he got back to me and said, first off, you need to apply for the PhD because you're way too qualified for just the master's. Which already, you know, stroked my ego.
Yes. And
so, and then he basically said, I know I don't focus in Scotland, but I've advised plenty of dissertations, much like what you're interested in all parts of Europe. I have connections all over. I can get you set up alongside any connections you have yourself. I'm happy to advise anything loosely related. It was weirdly perfect for something that sure. I was not at all intending on truly going to. Mm-hmm. And now it's my, not only my top pick, it's where I've accepted my, they accepted me. I've said, yes, that's where I'm going.
Yeah. And I love this story because that's how it's done. You know, I have this odd feeling in my chest right now. I'm pretty sure it's called pride.
Ooh.
Yeah,
that must I know. Be a new one for you.
It's very strange. It's very strange.
Pride for yeah. somebody else. Wow. Yeah,
not for myself. I don't know. Hopefully it'll pass. But I really dig how you did this because I'd seen you, you know, apply to these various places and you have this interest that's a bit specific. But the way that you kind of stuck it all together, make it work for you and reaching out and making those connections, it's like, that's how it's done, man. I hope that other students hear your story in terms of how you ultimately got to Buffalo and also know that you applied to a bunch of other places. You got denied a bunch of other places. You stayed in it, you know, and you ultimately found a place that to me sounds about as close to perfect as you can get, you know, for your interest. So I just, I think you just played that game exactly right, my friend. And, you know, I hope other students can kind of, again, take from this. It's like you don't just apply to two places and when you hear no, go, oh, well, I guess I'll walk away. You didn't. And it worked out fantastic.
Well, thank you. I think the best thing for any students or emerging professionals listening, whether it be in CRM or academia or any other, if there are any other facets of archaeology you can make money off of.
Podcasting.
True, for podcasting, yeah. for whatever you're trying to do, the best thing you can do is just reach out to people and just see what's out there, even if it isn't your top pick or whatever, because anything can eventually snowball into something else, or even just having experience under your belt, which so many of us don't, unfortunately, just gives you such an edge. So just like keep an eye out, even if it isn't your top pick, just, or even if it seems intimidating, just reach out and find something. And for me, at least, it all worked out.
Right. No, I think that's great. My own story is very similar to that. I was like, Riverside, what? There's a school out there, you know, and it's very similar. So I think that a lot of us have that same story. So anyway, good for you, man.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to take a break, and we'll come back on the other side and wrap this up. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 261. And we are talking to Griffin Fox. And Griffin, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, I'm just going to lay this on you. You know, you're going to school, you're going for a PhD program. What is your desired ultimate goal in archaeology? Like, where would you say you've like, okay, this is where I've wanted to be, this is where I want to go, or are you still making that decision?
So overall, my end goal, I would like to teach, and I'd like to do so in a way similar to Kinkella and others who have taught me, where I can actually provide undergraduates and graduate students with actual field opportunities and other things of that nature. Because I was lucky enough to get exposed to that sort of thing early on. But like I said earlier, most people that I've talked to did not. And I think that's a big problem in archaeology that I'd like to do my part to help fix. So whether that be in the four-year world or at a community college, either of those would be great. I know that those jobs are difficult to get into, and I'm happy to just keep working in CRM if I really can't find a job in something like that. Mm-hmm. Especially now, like having met Murray, who, while he is a CRM, for lack of a better word, archaeologist, he still has that opportunity to teach people about archaeology and engage with the community. Anything wherein I can do that, I'm happy with, basically.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too. So would your focus be more on, I mean, actually be on like, I don't know, like the, you can get degrees and courses of study in public archaeology and, you know, those areas of study? Or are you looking to focus in an area and then while you're doing your PhD, like for your dissertation, and then get a teaching job somewhere, hopefully, and fulfill those, I guess, the public archaeology dreams from that side of things? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, yeah, basically, once I get the PhD and hypothetically get a job, which, you know, big if these days. Yeah, let's say that happens. What I'd like to do is run some manner of field school if I can, whether it be just a local thing in the area that I'm living or an over the summer in Scotland type thing, whatever I can get my dirty little hands on, basically, and just allow for undergraduate students to get that experience. Even if they don't have an interest in like pursuing archaeology, just to give them that opportunity, anything like that, just getting archaeology out there more to a wider audience. That's more or less my goal in a very basic sense.
Well, that's more or less the goal of the Archaeology Podcast Network, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that'd be a great direction to go, given your interest of wanting to share with others, because it opens you up to more positions, right? Like you're not 100% beholden onto getting a teaching job. And I think that a lot of folks, you know, when they really start to fixate on that whole teaching job thing, then they'll just take anything that comes along. And it's like, you know, okay, well, if you didn't get at the highest level school, then you'll take the next highest level and you'll take the next lowest level. And then you get to the point where, you know, you're just getting abused by some university because you wanted to be a professor
in your goals there, there's a lot of room for flexibility, because you could get a job with, you know, regional parks or the NPS or, you know, some other kind of local organization. Because, I mean, it is rare for someone to have something like what's going on in Scotland for a city to have an archaeologist, but it's not rare for there to be some kind of historic preservation commission or park service or something like that. And then you get to be on the historic properties, or you get to be on the cultural resources, and your whole goal is to share that with the community. And so you end up in that situation where you are teaching field schools, like partnering with universities or connecting with high school students or middle school students and giving them those chances to go out and do, you know, what you love, while you don't have to deal with all the stuff of working at a university.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that brings a whole new universe into your, you know, life, because, you know, professors are not normal. Andrew can attest to that. Maybe he's normal. I think Andrew might be the most normal professor, but
I am so normal. So normal.
That's a very strong accusation.
You and your backyard pool are so normal, right? Yeah, it's normal to just let rain collect in your backyard and swim in it.
That's what I do.
I'm adding the swimming part. Sorry. I don't know if you're actually swimming in it.
He does. He does backstrokes in there. I've seen it. We live very close together. I drive past it all the time.
That's right.
You drive through it all the time as it floods into the street. Nobody likes Andrew's house. Dude, it's flooding into everyone else's yard.
It may or may not be doing that right at this moment, Bill. Just so you know.
That's all right. Who am I to point fingers?
Who are you?
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, folks find themselves in that kind of situation where they're super being coached to go into academia. And it's coming from people who made it, right? So there's kind of a, like, I don't know, it's weird. It's like a weird place to emphasis on stuff that doesn't matter for what you're talking about. You want to share your craft with others. They want you to write, you know, glorified blog posts and get them published into journals and, you know, bow down to get a couple hundred dollars in grant money. And they'll pat you on the back for that when you're shaking your head like, you know, I could have ran an entire field school with a local college and had them do a lot of the work, and then me just partner along with it and got paid more than I would at this university. So I think that, you know, being open to it, it doesn't mean that if you get a tenure track job, you can't do what Andrew is doing. It just means that it's going to be in a different environment, right? With different cohort of colleagues, with different goals, and almost none of them dovetail with what you want to do.
Yeah, for sure. And I think going off the flexibility thing you're saying, I think COVID definitely taught me a lot about that, because especially in, like, you know, a global pandemic, your options are very much limited and you have to kind of deal with what's being offered to you. And from what I've gathered and even experienced in my emerging professional career, the same is very much true in archaeology in a general sense. The options are already, there's not a ton, like, you can't, if you want to just settle on one specific thing, like, I want to work at a four-year or whatever, you're going to find yourself kind of limited in the scope of what you can actually do. And I'm not big on that. I want to have options. So yeah, I just.
Right on. Yeah. And, you know, you'll also find yourself competing against other people who will do literally anything to get this job. Right. And so,
yeah, that too.
If you don't want to sacrifice who you are as a person, then, you know, watch out, because there'll be dozens of people who are willing to do that just to say that they're a professor.
Yes, I've met some already.
I met plenty.
I bet.
Yeah, I just totally agree. Well, I'm going to go ahead and agree with every single thing that Bill just said. Totally, totally true. And I love that part, Bill, where you're talking about these people who've already made it are telling you that, you know, you can do it too. Yeah. It's like Tom Cruise telling you that you can be an actor too.
Right.
You know, and it's like, not exactly. Yeah. You know, they have long left the real world of, like, okay, here's the steps to get to here. The chances are very low, but, you know, here's other opportunities just in case along the way, if this looks terrible. You never hear them talk about that stuff. And that always bums me out. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's my job every day.
Right. Dude, it's like, but we laugh, but I know it is. It's my job too. You know, and it's such an important job to be like, here's reality, you know, and it's unfortunate in my experience in the academic world that they don't want to hear reality.
Yeah.
That always just freaks me out.
It is concerning. At your SCA presentation the other day, at seeing the crowd's responses to some of the things you were saying, which were more or less what we were just talking about.
I wish I'd seen that.
It was it was quite funny in an unfortunate sort of way.
Yeah.
You've got 3 minutes, Andrew. Recap. I missed it. What happened?
It was Heather and I.
Yeah, actually, I know. I'm
so bummed she's not here right now. But we just gave a little talk about like alternate ways of learning archaeology. You know, we talked about basically what we do. We talked about podcasting. We talked about books. We talked about blog posts and other places to get archaeological knowledge. You know, all the stuff we always talk about on here. And we talked about getting jobs. We talked about the reality of this kind of stuff, the stuff that you and I were just talking about. We just brought these things up. We did a real world moment where it was like, hey, the real chances of these kind of jobs is this. Why not think about these other things? And the audience was, you know, they always react in that sort of cold, you know, frigid sort of manner. Now, I'm not to say everyone reacted like that. I'm not here to say we got booed off the stage or something, but you can always feel it. There's a big contingent of the stop telling me about reality crowd.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
And I've seen it a lot of times.
Right. And again, I always find it so odd. I remember when I was a grad student asking professors about real world, you know, things like what are the chances of me truly getting a job? And they looked at me like I was just the devil. And the worst part was one of my fellow students took me aside and said, Andrew, please stop asking that. Yeah. And I'm like, what? You don't want to know? And he actually said, no.
Wow.
I'm like, what? So
yeah.
Anyhow,
yeah,
my little mini rant. But I want to hear more about Griffin, your rant.
Yeah.
You know,
I could rant for hours. What do you want me to rant about?
Well, you know, one of the things I'd ask is you're like an up and coming scholar. So, you know, what are the directions you'd like to see archaeology take?
Well, like we've touched on, I'd like to see a more public outreach approach. I think that the disparity between CRM and academia has gotten very bad. I know a lot of times it's played as a joke, and it's fun to like mess with either side, be like, oh, you CRM or you academics, whatever. But I think on some level there is a genuine rivalry there that should not exist, because there really does need to be, what's the word, collaboration between the two if we want archaeology to actually be formidable. Too many academics are just publishing for, like you said, a couple $100 worth of grant money, and then it's not actually producing any meaningful research. And I do think at its core, archaeology is about researching the past and better understanding it. And I think on some level, even the most academic of academics have kind of lost sight of that, because it's just become more about getting the grant money, rehashing the same things, not doing the real field work that's required to actually get an understanding of the past. And I don't know, I'd just like to see that gap healed, and I'd like to do my part to fix that.
Yeah, right on. I definitely second that, because CRM folks, you know, are out there collecting this huge amount of data, and those companies that have been around for a long time, you know, they're really regionally focused because their office is in, you know, Phoenix or Milwaukee or whatever. And so they've got these projects that are within 500 miles, like gigabytes of points and photos and documents and all that stuff. And so, you know, those folks, you know, some of those bigger companies could be really regional professionals on certain kinds of archaeology, that if you had access to all that data and you were at a university and you could, you know, you had the time to write these articles, like that could be monumental, because these reports and the data are really kind of stuck behind this, you know, wall for good reason. Because, you know, we don't want these sites to get compromised. So that stuff goes to the SHPO and it just sits in this warehouse, right? Well, academics that have time to, you know, write on these kind of things and have access to these thousands and thousands of GIS points, tons and tons of site shapes, variation, all these different summaries over 20 to 30 years. Like, you know, that's the kind of stuff that some university could really have a field day with, an army of graduate students and, you know, scholars writing on this region's history and all this different stuff that's coming from this data set. Like, that could be, you know, really huge. It would give you the time depth, even though you didn't collect all the data, to have access to all this stuff way more than our small field schools and our one-off, you know, weekends and 6 weeks over in St. Croix. You have access to all this information, but the CRM folks don't have time to just sit there and write journal articles and books. Whereas that's the goal of the, it seems like that's the main thing they want you to do in academia. So I do see where there'd be this really huge and fruitful potential for collaboration between companies and scholars and graduate students and stuff. But just like you were saying, it's kind of closed off because CRMers are kind of running around like, what's my next thing? What's my next hit? What's my next hit? And then the academics are thinking, oh, well, that data, that doesn't meet our standards, when it's crazy because, you know, a lot of these companies, they've really refined these recording and, you know, documentation standards. They're set by the state and they're recorded, you know, it's gotten better and better over time. So it's kind of crazy that folks are overlooking that whole potential right now, you know, and as you, as a young scholar, like tapping into that kind of thing, like that would be something that would make your research way bigger than it is because you have tons, and it'd be the kind of stuff that states and CRM companies really want to see happen regionally. And you get to do exactly what you're talking about by including students and communities and everybody else in, you know, at the level that they're able to participate. I mean, I think that's great.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the material is all there to work with. The talent is all there. Everything to make it, like what we're saying, is there. It's just a matter of actually breaking down that barrier. And that is something I would hope to see happen in the near future.
Yeah, and I felt like that, in a way, Murray Cook and the field school in Scotland kind of gives you the key to that. You know, that's one of the things I thought was so interesting. It's like, oh, that meld of those places is already happening. It can happen. Yeah. You know, because sometimes here in the U.S., like, oh, it's never going to happen. And it's like, dude, they're doing it.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think there's even pockets of it in the U.S., but it's definitely not the standard. And they're all, you know, very small, kind of isolated projects that don't often get highlighted. I think it's a little easier in the UK or places like Europe because it's so intrinsically tied to the city and the government and all that. But there's nothing truly stopping us from doing that in the United States as well. It's just a matter of organizing, I feel like. Mm-hmm. It'll be different, of course, like than it is in other countries, but the potential is still there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think that's about all we have time for. Thank Griffin for coming on. And, you know, we, of course, wish you, you know, good luck in all your endeavors and your PhD program. And maybe we can have you on again sometime in the future to talk about that and how it's going.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you for having me. This was awesome.
All right. Well, with that, I think, thank Andrew for bringing on Griffin. And we will come back next time with, I'm sure, a fantastic show. Maybe not something as polarizing as job satisfaction, the last episode, which I've already seen some comments on that. Oh, man.
I love the part where you were like, send all emails to Andrew Kinkella.
Yeah, if anybody has any complaints about me, Kinkella taught me everything I know. Also, so,
that's right. Yeah, that's right. Nice. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you guys next time.
Goodbye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.